Should someone not present him?
Working.
Like, so, introduce him.
First of all,
all right, now it's absolutely.
Thank you very much for the invitation. I think it's last time in Zurich, very cool place here from a cultural perspective, not so much from a temperature perspective, of course, but I think we will get that done. My name is Wolfgang Meyer. I'm head of the hardware development team in the IBM Research and Development Lab in Böblingen. My team is about 300 engineers, mostly logic designers. And we heard about Power8 a little bit, and this is a significant design components of the Power8 actually are developed in my team. So sometimes it's not that well known that a lot of process development is still done here in Germany, since, of course, Intel has most of their development teams sitting in the U.S. What I want to do today, I want to talk a little bit about Power8. I want to talk a little bit about hardware technology in common, not only Power8. And as we have heard before, I listened to the presentation, and there were two parts. The first part was about the spreadsheet stuff and the roadmap. And then there was the what the developer called the fancy stuff, of course. And pretty much when I hear software guys talking about the fancy stuff, there is a kind of alarm bell ringing in myself, because this means these guys need more performance in the future, as usual. Okay. And now, if we really want to deliver more performance, we have to think a little bit about Moore's Law. This is what I want to start with, because I think when we look at the last 30 years or so, performance was not a big issue. And the reason for that was we had very huge steps forward in semiconductor technology. Gordon Moore did a bold statement in the 1960s, which said, okay, within the next decades, we can raise performance every 2 years by a factor of two. And I think in his equation, the first thing he was focusing on was number of transistors on a chip. I think when we look at the projection, Moore's Law pretty much was fulfilled almost perfectly over 40 years now, or almost 50 years. But I think what Gordon Moore really meant, or how the Moore's Law is interpreted, it's not only about the technical stuff, it's also about the economical stuff. This means we can produce more performance actually for more or less the same price relation as we had it in the almost in the 60s. And I think if we could not resolve this equation in that way, the complete digital development of the last 30, 40 years would not have been possible, because we couldn't have afforded it. That's, I think, what we should keep in mind. So that's also why I picked this one and called it Moore's Law. What we see here, more or less pretty much since the 1950s, we could lower the cost of single calculation, more or less, and divide it by two every 2 years. This means today, when we talk about petaflops or big number of flops, actually, then this was only possible because we had all this development. Okay. Now, as a hardware developer, looking at that a little bit closer, what we see is the patterns have changed over the last 5 to 6 years. Since besides the number of transistors we had on that hardware, the other strong source of performance actually had been frequency. There had been another law which is not that popular. It's the so-called Dennard law. Frequency could be raised because with the smaller transistors, actually the power consumption of these transistors also declined. Now, as we are so far down in the atoms already.
I have to get closer to that.
As we are so far down in the atoms, we could not raise frequency that much over the last 5 to 10 years. The reason for that is that there is a pretty strong dependency between power consumption and frequency. And more or less with frequency, we have arrived at the break even something like 5 years ago. And what you see is, of course, Intel is interpreting that in a little bit different way than we do. We have some special technologies, but more or less between 3 and 5 gigahertz is where we have to more or less give up on the frequency level. Okay, and this means when we want to allow a development like this and raise performance and pretty much support all your creativity in the future, we have to rethink a little bit how we can produce performance so that this equation will stay alive. Because if this equation is not alive, then the affordability of all the things which we call big data and all the other hype is much more difficult than we'd like to have that. Okay, and what I want to do today a little bit is to demonstrate and show some features, some thoughts, share some thoughts on how we can catch up with equation, with this equation also in the future, and what power technology and IBM, of course, is doing in order to do that. So now, one thing is what we see here. This is still a technology feature. Okay, so far the main driver always was semiconductor technology, and the question is, can semiconductor technology not contribute anymore to performance improvements or to cost performance improvements? And the answer is, well, there are still some features which can help here, and this is a typical one of that. As we cannot raise frequency, we go towards parallelization. Okay, this means you have all seen this trend. We go from double core to 8-core to 12-core designs. This will also continue for a certain while, because we still have lithography, actually, which allows us to put more transistors on the chip. But in order to make more cores on the chip also efficient, you have to build an infrastructure on the chips which helps you to get these to get these engines really in the mode where they can work efficiently. And one very important part in that is that you have cache structures on the chip, stage cache structures actually, and big cache structures. Okay, and what we see here is a technology which allows you to build much bigger caches actually on your chip. And as we will see later on a little bit, of course, Power8, for example, is very famous for its big cache structures. Now, that doesn't come by itself. This comes by this technology. And this technology is something we do especially for our chips. It's called Deep Trench. And it works in that way that usually, in order to realize cache structures on a chip, you use so-called SRAM cells. And SRAM cells consume something like 6 transistors. Okay. Now, what we found out is if you are capable to build a relatively high capacity on a chip, you can also build a cell which consumes just 2 transistors in so-called DRAM cell. DRAM technology is used in memory. So far, it was not possible to integrate that directly into the chip. With this technology, it's possible. And what you do is, deep trench means you etch a relatively deep hole into the silicon, and with this deep hole, you are capable to build a high capacity. Okay, you blow some metal dust into that, and you have a perfect capacitor. And this means this allows you to build these 2 transistor DRAM cells on the chip, and this means you get a cache density which is a factor 3 compared to SRAM cell. And as we will see later on, in the comparison, this allows us to build these extremely high caches or big caches. Now, of course, usually in these equations, there is a burden. You have to pay for it. The burden in this case is the etching process in order to burn the hole takes something like 6 weeks. Since, I mean, it's just 4 micrometer, but 4 micrometer is a relatively deep hole in a processor. Okay, so this 6 weeks, of course, is something which you miss in your development cycle, and as we, of course, all struggle with time to market, this is something which specifically we as developers, of course, we love to have the big caches, but we hate to pay 6 weeks for it, actually, in our development cycle. So that's the equation around here. Then, of course, another thing is you need the big caches, but as we have so much traffic, I mean, we have a superscalar out of order architecture on these chips now with a multi-cores. You can imagine it's not quite simple to exchange all the data in between. This morning when I pretty much traveled from Stuttgart to Nuremberg, I got a proof again on what it means to have congestion on the Autobahn in this case. I mean, you have a similar situation in a processor today, okay? You have several cores. All these cores have a lot of different units, and there are a lot of guys actually who want to run their threads through this cores, since we do, as we see later, we also do simultaneous multi-threading. And of course, it's extremely important to have infrastructure in place, buses in place, which allows you to keep these things efficient. And this is also a difference, actually, which we have compared to other chip producers. We use another stack, actually. What you can see on the left side, this is pretty much an electron scan microscope of a chip which we have cut in the middle. And you see there are 15 layers of metal. And pretty much down in the silicon today, we have something like 4 billion transistors. And of course, the more layers you have and the faster connections you have, the more efficient you can connect these transistors with one another. And we have special copper layers in there, also the stacked layers. And the number of layers, 50 metal layers, is much higher than with other vendors. And we will look at performance later on a little bit. As we heard before, Power8 is showing pretty good performance numbers. That does not mean that Intel doesn't, okay? And I try to explain a little bit what the difference is. But this is also one of the technology reasons why we still can get into this good performance numbers. Okay, then what I mentioned before, of course, is we get more parallel. Okay, this means when you look at a usual processor, well, at a Power8 core specifically, because what we build is, these are really heavy load cores. Okay, these are not any low power fancy stuff. Actually, we build big machines. Okay, that's our goal, and that's pretty much. It does not mean that a big machine always is better than a small machine, but that's how we understand our business. Okay, now usually when you run this mighty cores, of course they consume a little bit more power. We see that later on. But usually with today's implementations of software, where we do not take a lot of emphasis on parallelization, it's pretty difficult to completely utilize the complete core. Okay, this means when you look at the picture in a regular processor core, we have high number of different units, and when you run actually a thread through this a software thread through this unit, then mostly only a small number of these units really is utilized. The other part is more or less waiting till the other guys actually are getting done with their stuff, and then they get into play again with the next cycle. Okay, that's how it usually works. Now, of course, I mean, pretty simple. The question is, why don't we utilize these resources? Most of the processor vendors actually do that. Meanwhile, it's called hyper-threading with Intel. With Intel, we call it simultaneous multi-threading. This means now you implement also a supervision logic, actually, which is watching several threads, which we throw on this core in parallel. Okay, and this is what you see on the right side. You have a blue thread and you have a red thread. You can run these things in parallel. Now, of course, sounds very simple, for sure it's the right thing to do if you want to support these parallel structures. But as a user, you have to use a feature like that a little bit more carefully than the things before, which we have heard before. Big caches, I mean, you don't have to take a lot of into regard when you write your software. When you want to exploit a feature like that in the right way, you have to, okay? Because it does not fit into every workload approach. It only fits if parallelization fits to the workload. It's also something which has to be kind of balanced in regard to the configuration, cache sizes, memory sizes, and to the specific workload. Let me give an example. We had a POC running with Yandex. Yandex is a huge Russian search engine, pretty much the counterpart to Google in the more Kirillian letters space. They started to work with Power8 on their own and were a little bit disappointed actually at the beginning because they could not really figure the sweet spot for example, simultaneous multi-threading. Okay, so we did some POC. They had to do some adjustments in their code. And on top of that, they had to learn that if you run on highest SMT mode, that does not mean you got best performance. Okay. In differentiation to Intel, we have different modi. You can run SMT1, which is pretty much non-SMT. SMT2, so you can run two SMT threads in parallel, SMT4 and SMT8. Okay. And the sweet spot, of course, does not mean SMT8 is always the best choice. In their case, for example, they could get to performance improvement with this a little bit twiggling in the code, actually, which was around factor 3. When we got to SMT8 mode and tried that, actually, we dropped down again to something like 1.5. Okay, so it's something you have to take into regard. Also, at the beginning, of course, we got some surprises. Since, of course, you have to pay a little burden in order to keep the threads actually separated from one another. This means if you have a benchmark which is focused on single thread performance, you may get a little bit surprised about that because, I mean, of course, we have technology improvements and we also raise single thread performance. But in this case, let me do a simple example. You have two threads, actually, and each thread takes 1 second. Okay. So when you are in single thread mode, of course, the complete runtime is 1 plus 1, this is 2 seconds. Okay. Now you say, okay, great, I have a simultaneous multi-threading, I throw it in this mode. You get to a little bit burden, and we say, okay, each thread now takes 1.2 seconds. Okay. So it's still better. I mean, you got from 2 seconds to 1.2 seconds, which is improvement. Now, if you have a benchmark which is focusing on single thread only, you get worse, okay? Because you got from 1 second to 1.2 seconds. So you have to be very careful also when you try to leverage a feature like that actually to exploit it in the right way, okay? And I think this is also kind of the pattern we see more and more. We need a stronger collaboration between software guys, hardware guys, virtualization guys actually, because the stack function is taking more and more focus in the complete performance evaluation and in the efficiency evaluation. Okay. Okay. So this one thing, of course, there are other features which maybe are a little bit easier to exploit. For example, like SIMD engines. This is just vectorization of floating point units and things like that. Another very interesting area is the field of hardware acceleration. This means you really implement special function components. The reason why hardware acceleration has get a bigger hype within the last 5 to 10 years is one part is FPGA technology has made good progress forward, and the other part is now that we have this big number of transistors available on the processor, we pull in more functions into the processor scope. Okay, this means in the past we usually had a proprietary interface out of the processor into a I/O hub function, which was a separate chip. Meanwhile, we implement this chip directly into the processor and are on the step actually to include that cache coherently to the rest of the caches. This means you got way faster I/O attachments and you got way smaller latencies, and this means you can leverage these acceleration techniques much more efficiently than you could in the past. Okay. Overall, I think there are different types of accelerators which we distinguish in this context. Accelerators in common is a big field. We also have on-processor development. This is also a on-processor accelerator. This is also a trend we see. There we reserve some of the transistors actually and implement special functions. You see that on the power, for example, for compression purposes or for encryption purposes, we have special acceleration engines actually which do that. This, what I want to put a little bit light on here is specifically the area of GPU attachments. GPU graphical processors have a good ecosystem. This means there is a programming language you can use, and there is also a more easier way actually to integrate that into your operating system flow by having device drivers, all that stuff. So from that perspective, GPUs are very interesting right at the moment. For example, the Forschungszentrum Jülich runs a huge supercomputing project in the human brain space where human brain functions are simulated. They do a very sophisticated balancing between Power 8 compute power and GPU compute power for parallelization purposes. Since these graphical processors, they are not quite that powerful as, for example, a Power 8 core, but of course their number is relatively high and they do not consume too much power. Okay, so that's a good thing. Of course, you need some knowledge how to integrate that into your flow. The other very interesting part is the so-called FPGAs. FPGAs are special hardware which you can program in a certain language. Altera has come up with a language called OpenCL, which from our perspective is very well suited to do quick and fast, quick and dirty, I would say, prototype development. If you want to use an FPGA in a product-like environment, it's a little bit more difficult because there, OpenCL certainly is not the best choice because you don't get all the capabilities of the FPGA. There you should really use languages like VHDL or Verilog because they make it more efficient. And this, of course, means then you need some experts. I mean, for us as processor developers, it's not a big deal, but for software development guys, getting in that deep kind of hardware languages, of course, is a little bit more difficult. So from that perspective, the consumability of this is certainly a little bit more complicated than with GPUs, but from an efficiency perspective, you can accelerate specific workloads factor 1,000. For example, for Monte Carlo simulation, we have seen effects like that in the high-frequency trading stuff. But the effort, of course, also is relatively high. Okay, and then, of course, there is one... there's some other stuff. I don't want to go in too much detail. You can use these fast interfaces for in-memory database processing. Actually, for example, using non-volatile storage like flash instead of DIMMs and stuff like that. And then there is, of course, a very interesting new area. I just want to allude a little bit here, but say some more words at the end. This is the area of neurosynaptic. This means there we use completely new processor architectures which don't run with high frequencies, but which are very close aligned to the human brain function, and for that reason have power efficiencies which are a factor 10,000 higher than with the usual von Neumann architecture. I will talk about that in a little bit later on. But the idea here is also, of course, to use this type of hardware then for special hardware acceleration purposes for special work, okay? Specifically pattern recognition in this case. Okay, so that's these are the sources of, these are some of the sources actually which you can use to gain more performance to resolve the Moore's law equation in a good way. Now, of course, in Power 8, just examples of that, all of these features are implemented. I talked about the big caches. I talked about the SMT. As I mentioned before, we have SMT 2, 4, 8 mode. We are just rethinking the SMT 8 right at the moment. We could not find a lot of applications which really use SMT 8, so maybe it makes sense to stay somewhere at SMT 4. We have a SIMD engine in. Of course, we have extremely high memory bandwidth. In order to gain this memory bandwidth, actually, we have built a special chip. It's up to 230 gigabytes per second. I mean, of course, talking about SAP HANA, for example, everyone sees that doing most of the work directly in exchange between processor and memory is getting more and more interesting. So for that reason, we have implemented that. And then what we have done on top of that, we have optimized this direct PCI interface which gets out of the processor. And we call that coherent accelerator processor interface. We will continue to improve that in the future as we see accelerators getting more and more importance. The background on that is this. Usually when you run a PCI interface directly from the processor, you use a traditional I.O. protocol, which makes the thing a little bit slower and the latency a little bit higher, because you don't have a feature like, for example, InfiniBand, which is called RDMA. You have more or less load store functions, okay? And these load store functions do not allow to have a real cache-coherent integration of these external components. Now, we have integrated a protocol layer, which is a kind of workaround around that. And this means with this coherent attached processor interface, you can now integrate external components and have them cache coherently integrated into your overall workload. Okay, so this means you get something like factor 2 to 3 latency improvements versus a regular, just plain vanilla PCI attachment, which you have in this PCI slot. Okay, and we have come up with a Power8 Plus version. This copy interface has a lot of advantages in playing together with FPGA acceleration. In order to get the same advantages also with GPU acceleration, we have implemented another link, which is so-called NVLink, NV for NVIDIA. And this is, for example, one of the features which is massively used in this human brain project in the first instance of NVLink. Okay, so just to show up a little bit of differences. Now, when we compare that, as I mentioned before, first of all, I mean, I have a lot of respect for the Intel guys. I mean, they really do a good job. They really give us a hard time to stay competitive. But I think what's important is we have a little bit different philosophy than Intel has. And I want to use this chart and also look at the performance numbers to demonstrate that a little bit. What you clearly see is Intel has more or less given up on frequency at something around 3.4 gigahertz. As you can see, this comes in a something like 150 watt envelope, which is doable, okay? And we have a little bit different philosophy. We said, okay, we are capable to build system designs because we have a lot of experience in the enterprise machines. We go up to 250 watts. We pay that, but we go also up to 5 gigahertz. Okay, so you can certainly resolve this equation in different ways. Intel is doing that in this way. We do it in the other way. The reason why we can run this 5 gigahertz is what we have seen before. This deep trench capabilities, this deep trench features, which I brought up in the context of caches, you can also use that for frequency decoupling or for circuit decoupling. This means if you really want to go up to 5 gigahertz, you have to have a feature like that. Otherwise, you are not allowed to do so. Okay, and you also have to burn down your gate oxide stuff. Then you see we have different cache structures which are much bigger. We have higher memory bandwidth, actually. We have addressable memory, which is much bigger in the range of 16 terabyte, for example, for the E880 system. And when you pull all this together and look at that more from a parameter perspective, then RPE2 is actually a relatively good benchmark. RPE2 uses kind of empirical data and allows you to compare Intel architecture to Power architecture and also compare it to earlier generations. What you see is Intel is running a strategy that they say our core performance more or less stays the same. This is also now in the Haswell-Broadwell transition of their Xeon architecture. As you can see, they even go a little bit lower now at 2.2 gigahertz. We with Power8, we go up in per core performance. So at the same time, of course, we are at somewhere at 3.5 gigahertz. And when you remember the chart before, The philosophy of Intel is to go towards a higher number of cores instead of just raising frequency. So that's pretty much what I want to bring up here. It's different approach. And with this different approach, you can see that when you compare benchmarks, with this different approach, you get results where for some of the benchmarks, which kind of reflect certain workloads, you are more or less, you got a wash. But then for other specific workloads, you got performance increase factor 2.5. Okay, and I think the important thing is you really have to learn a little bit about Power8 in order to figure actually which is the right workload to fit to this engine. Okay, it's certainly not in that case that every engine, that every workload is the right thing for this engine. You need to invest a little bit, but if you find a workload which fits to that, you of course can get to way higher efficiencies than with the other hardware, for example. Okay, so that's what I want to bring up a little bit today. So now, looking forward, it's getting more obvious that, and you heard, I talked a lot about cache sizes and frequency and all that stuff. Going even further, actually, out into the future, I think this discussion will still be vital, but there will be more and more other areas which will get more attention. Specifically in the microarchitecture area. Since, what we think about right at the moment is to come up with more flexible structures. Actually, you see the roadmap here. We have also new semiconductor technologies. But I think the real discussion right at the moment is about can we come up with flexible core designs, which, for example, allow you to combine cores in a kind of modular way, because what I described before, in a certain sense, you have kind of resources which you can share on a processor, and the question of course is how efficiently can you balance these resources against each others. And the idea is to build kind of modular cores which allow you to run in a kind of 1-to-4 mode, so you have either one smaller component, actually, which does not get too many resources, but you can combine it with other cores, for example, pull it together as a 4-core unicore, which then has a higher number of resources, or you can, for example, use just 3 of these minor cores and combine it with a special purpose engine, like an accelerator or stuff like that. So these are the discussions which we have, which we see right at the moment for future products. Of course, we are right at the moment, we are working on the Power 9, which is a 14 nanometer chip. My team fortunately released the first release to the Fed, to GlobalFoundry, last week. This means within the next 3 months, we will get the first hardware, and then we get into a mighty test cycle, actually. And so pretty much, I think, in the 2017 timeframe, we then will see the first Power 9 chips. And Power 9 will already realize some of these ideas, which I just alluded to. Okay, so, and going further out, then, of course, what we call Power 10, there are already plans, actually, concepts started. Which then will go even more intensively into that direction. Okay, maybe just to give you a little bit of impression about such a project, usually it takes something like 4 to 5 years to develop a processor like that. Okay, before you get to market. This means you start with a concept phase, for example, for Power 10, which then will show up somewhere around 2020. We are in concept phase right at the moment. After, and this takes something... It depends a little bit on how fast, actually, you can integrate all the various characters who have their opinion, actually, what the processors should look like. After that, then you go into high-level design. You really break it down to, is this a 20-core design or is this a 24-core design, things like that. Then you get into implementation. You write all the logic design, which takes something like half a year. And then somewhere around 18 months before you can go to market, you really send the design data into the fab. And at the fab, of course, you have a pretty complicated process. Actually, they build masks, they set up all the lithography environment, they run certain tests in order to prove if the technology really is capable to realize your chip in the end. And then you get back the first hardware, you do the initial testing, which takes something like 3 to 4 months, and then you have one other shot before you go into the GA, where actually where you can fix all the bugs you still find in such a process. So this means you always have a very long lead time until you get into the market. And this means right at the moment, of course, we run with Power 8. Power 9 is in the pipe, actually, and Power 10, of course, is in concept right at the moment, just to give you a little impression about that. Okay? So, now we talked a lot about technology, technical stuff, but besides that, there is one other thing which is very important, very, very important trend. What we see more and more is, while we have developed a lot of proprietary stuff over the last 20, 30, 40 years, within the last 10 years, we see a clear trend towards openness. Okay, and of course, when I say last 10 years, guys like you, you would laugh and say, well, already in the 80s we saw Linux, but for the hardware, this is a little bit different. Hardware had been kind of closed systems. I mean, there had been not too much cooperation between teams. There had been some competing parties, but it was more difficult to cooperate. Now, as you have seen before, if you really want to realize such more solution-like systems, which, for example, leverage accelerators, then I think the equation that this is done by one company is getting more and more difficult. This is what we realized for a very long time. And the consequence, actually, is that we say, well, similar what we see have seen, actually, with Linux, this could be also done in the hardware space. You just have to demonstrate the willingness to open up your architecture, actually, and maybe also come up with a foundation which allows you to stronger cooperate with other partners. And this is pretty much what happened in 2013 when we and other companies like Mellanox and like Google and like NVIDIA came up with the Open Power Foundation. The Open Power Foundation gives a completely new flexible framework which allows you to build hardware in a totally different way than you have done in the past. And it's not only about hardware, it's also about operating systems, virtualization, yada, 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 applications. Okay? Now, the background story on that is the following. Maybe you remember somewhere back in 2012, IBM had run this Jeopardy game with our Watson software. I think this was a little bit of a step into a new era. We had the Deep Blue, which was playing chess, okay, and where we could demonstrate some human capabilities of such a machine. And I think Jeopardy was a step forward. And of course, when we run that on the US TV, there was a company called Google, which was pretty interested in what technology this is, since overall, when we look into the future, I think this what we call cognitive approaches and all that is getting more and more interesting, specifically in the research area. And of course, they also understood that this machine-human interface, specifically in this case of Watson, was solved in a pretty impressive way. And so they contacted us and asked, well, what technology is that? And in this discussion, they also learned that, for example, the Watson technology is completely realized in power technology. And with this cooperation, actually, which we started with them, they came up with some ideas which were very typical for us, for this new kids on the block, like Google, like Amazon, like Rackspace, like Facebook, which out of the sudden had been very well suited players in the IT landscape, and their idea was pretty much to tell us, well, look, we have shifted the paradigm. We will not buy any boxes from you as I don't know, Daimler or Deutsche Bank or here in the German space will do, since we build our systems ourselves. Okay, but we can of course work together. We are very interested in your technology, but this would really mean you have to come up with a legal foundation which allows us to use your technology in the same context as we can do it, for example, with Intel. And our response was, okay, we got the message, and we will do that, and then we will go even one step further. We will also give the possibility to open up our complete microarchitecture of the processor. And obviously, this was the right direction we were hitting. This brought us into a POC together with Google, and this means, meanwhile, a big part of their search engine is not running on Intel x86 anymore, but is running on Power technology. But on top of that, there was a lot of notion, of course, about this new approach. And now, meanwhile, we also have some technology partnerships with companies, specifically in the Chinese space, which come up with their own ideas on how to build a processor based on Power 8 technology. This means we have one partner right at the moment. It's Shisu PowerCore, a Chinese company. They have built their own Power 8 processor chip. Background on that, of course, also was a little bit about the NSA discussion. They changed the crypto engine, they changed some of the floating point stuff into that, and they come up with a now more Chinese power flavored, actually, Power 8 processor. And on top of that, of course, they also start to operate in this open power context and build their own systems with new companies like Neucloud, like Moon. So we see a completely open new approach, actually, to come up with a new server portfolio in a certain sense, which, of course, for the architecture brings in a lot of benefits, since the more vital, actually, we get into that space, the more we can leverage all the technologies which are in place. We can get more experience about that. The ecosystem is growing by that, so very interesting to watch right at the moment. So that's the background, actually, and the idea about open power. Now, of course, as I said, Google and Facebook Rackspace are companies which are dealing with that, with these new capabilities in a very interesting way. That just for all of you, meanwhile, we are something like more than 200 members all over the world, actually, technology companies, integration companies, operating system companies, software companies, you call it. So very interesting to watch. Interesting approach here. There are other open approaches, like, for example, the Open Compute Project, which was initiated by Facebook. This is more on the system integration side. This means they say, well, we have a very good network worldwide, a lot of users. Why shouldn't we just put a spec into the web, actually, and ask if someone is interested in building a computer actually on based on that spec? That's what they started with Open Compute. Now this is combined with Open Power. They build a specific mezzanine system actually just for their purposes, and I think it's very interesting to see here how these two things, how these two open movements come together. Same here between Google and Rackspace. New thing for us actually is that they already plan for Power 9 CPUs. Power 9 so far is not part of the Open Power Foundation, but as you can see, as there is so much interest, I mean, this is probably one of the next steps that we do the announcements also from the IBM side. And so there are a lot of interest actually in order to use that. Okay, so that's the open power part, which allows more flexibility, which allows new business models, which allows completely new flexible system designs, which then are in better shape actually also to leverage all the capabilities such a platform actually can deliver. The other thing I mentioned before is also interesting to watch. It's not so much about power only, but you saw we had this neurosynaptic chip. I mean, one big trend we see right at the moment now, more from our IBM research perspective, is that this extremely high increase of this exponential growth of data, when you look a little bit closer, actually, this is you have to distinguish between the traditional IT, and I think there is some linear growth, but if you look at exponential growth, you mainly see that the data which are really growing faster are what we call data at the edge. This means these are data produced by cameras, by sensors, in the Internet of Things context, smartphones, and. And of course, this defines a little bit different equation, since in order to use this data, and obviously some very popular players use this very efficiently, you have a little bit different paradigms than in the past. Most of these data are not used so far. One of the reasons is that they are very transient. This means they lose meaning within seconds or so. The other part is that you don't have the bandwidth actually to get them into a cloud environment. And this means you really have to process them at the edge if you really want to use them. Okay? And this brings us to a field which is very interesting right at the moment to watch more from a research perspective, what we call brain-inspired systems. There you totally go away from Neumann architecture. You build many core chips, actually, and the cores, the small little cores, are not designed like floating point units or anything else. They are really directly aligned to the human brain function. This means you have neuron functions and synapse functions realized in a network. I mean, there had been a trend in the 80s, neural networks. This is similar to that, but now you have neural networks, actually, which are realized in a hardware structure and which come up with a way higher number, actually, of neurons. Okay, there's a lot of research done around that. In addition to that, there is this, a lot of discussion about machine intelligence in common right at the moment. So this means, how can we get to systems which are capable to learn instead of being programmed, which is also a very interesting field. And now for this specific case, for the neurosynaptic space, IBM has built a chip, so-called True North architecture, very high number of transistors. I mean, you can run such a chip for certain workloads with an efficiency raise in the area of something like 1,000, specifically when you do pattern recognition stuff. And at the same time, you just consume something like a factor 10,000 less power. This means you can use a chip like that in a, for example, in a smartphone and run it with a smartphone battery for something like a week without having any problems. And for us, of course, the big question now is how do we get to programming models, actually, in order to utilize it in the best way? How do these self-learning mechanisms look like, actually, to transport as a way a little bit from just real programming? At the moment, I think this is very much focused on research activities, but I think in the next 10 to 15 years, this will be very interesting to watch, since from a vision perspective, this could have same capabilities as the combination between von Neumann architecture with CMOS technology. The good thing is the CMOS technology is already there, so we don't have to invest into that. This is all about architecture and understanding how the brain function looks like. Okay? So just wanted to put that on the table at the end. But that's pretty much what I tried to share today, or wanted to share today with you on hardware. Are there any questions? No. Okay. Thank you very much.